mainly about bees, a little bit about birds later on. Today our show is about the honeybee, that industrious little insect that plays such a significant role in producing the food that we eat. That this wonderful creature is in trouble worldwide is a cause for real concern. What could be causing this? Today, Paul Judge speaks with Professor Peter Dearden from the University of Otago, a geneticist who focuses on honeybees, and who'll share his expert knowledge with us about what is happening to them. That interview coming up soon. Nō mai, haere mai, ko Sandra Kailaho, and it's my pleasure to bring you another Safe and Sound, the radio and podcast show that is a voice for the rights and welfare of all animals. We record at Free FM in Hamilton and are broadcast right across Aotearoa New Zealand via the Access Radio Sector. Our sponsors are Village Organics in Frankton. One of the reviews on their Facebook page says, I love this shop. It's full of such an amazing range of healthy, raw, unprocessed whole foods. They also do a delicious maca smoothie that is to die for. Best Organics in Hamilton, hands down. Very positive reviews, so if you haven't checked them out yet, they're in Commerce Street, Frankton, opposite the Frankton Hotel. So, Professor Peter Dearden's research focuses on the way evolution interacts with development, but also how the environment influences the way the genes and pathways work. Peter's work focuses particularly on insects and especially bees. Peter also has a strong interest in science communication and community engagement and was the director of Genetics Otago. He's currently the leader of the Lab in a Box project and the director of Genomics Aotearoa.
Hello, Professor Peter Dearden.
Hi there.
Welcome to Safe and Sound. It's great to have you on. We've been fascinated by bees for a long time on this show, and you know, most people know that bees are in trouble. Let's start by getting your take on where bees are at the moment in terms of, you know, the stresses that you define in some of your papers.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation because there's things that are happening to bees worldwide and there are things that are happening to bees here in New Zealand. I think worldwide, the story that many people have heard is that bees are in serious trouble. And a lot of that comes from studies in the United States and in Europe where there's very clear evidence that beekeeping is more difficult. Bee colonies are collapsing in some places, and actually there's a general decline in insects in some of those areas. In New Zealand, things aren't at that point yet. So actually, if you look at the number of bees and beehives in New Zealand, they have been increasing over the last few years, and that's mainly because of the boom in prices in Manuka honey. So there's lots more beekeepers out there. There's a lot more managed hives in New Zealand at the moment, so there should be a lot more bees out there. But what isn't really counted in that equation is that in about 2002, varroa mite arrived in New Zealand, and all the feral bees, the bees that you used to see out in the forest or on hillsides or that aren't being managed by beekeepers, those all died at about that time. So there's very few of those left. So we're not really sure, because we've never had a good survey of what was out there that wasn't being managed, we're not sure whether there are actually in total less bees, but certainly beekeepers are doing rather well in this country at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. We hear a lot about Manuka honey export trade. But the varroa mite, were you saying that it attacked some of the hives, or was it the... I understand there's native bees and there's imported bees, right?
Yeah, so varroa mite only attacks the western honeybee, which is the bee that has been brought to New Zealand as a way to produce honey and to improve pollination. It doesn't attack bumblebees, all of which are also imported, and it doesn't attack our native bees.
Oh, really? That's quite a bonus then for the native bee.
It is.
Just glancing over one of your papers this afternoon, I think the imported Western bees then that you're talking about impact on the native species, don't they?
Yes. So I guess the bees that we use to make honey are not native to New Zealand. And they were imported in the 1800s. They're now in lots of different environments. Before varroa mite, they were really through all our native forests as well. It's not clear that they're necessarily beneficial in those environments. And in fact, there's some evidence that they outcompete our native bees and other pollinators. They do spread weeds. We know that because they'll pollinate plants that they probably met in their home range, and those plants aren't necessarily things we want in New Zealand. So bees aren't necessarily great for all environments, but certainly in terms of our more managed environments, in terms of agriculture and horticulture, and even things like clover growing in high country pastures, honeybees are absolutely critical for those. So it's not very clear how much damage, if any, they do to pristine native environments, but they're certainly a key part of our more managed agriculture system.
So what are the main problems facing bees overseas? That we hear a lot about these, what they're referred to as neonics, neonicotinoid pesticides, which I believe some of the big companies like Bayer and so on are refusing to bow to pressure to ban them. And some of the countries in the European Union, for example, are trying to ban them and widening that ban. What's the story? What is that the main factor that's affecting them? There are other factors.
So there are lots of factors here. Neonicotinoids, I think, have got a bad reputation. And I think that we need to come back to that. So let me start with talking with some of the other problems. One of the big problems really is varroa mite. So varroa mite actually comes from a different species of bee, and it's crossed the species barrier and has become infective in honeybees. And just like things like the plague, which really was a disease of rodents, but when it flips into humans, it becomes extremely virulent. That's exactly what varroa mite has done. So on its native host, it's not really much of a problem. But in honeybees, it's a really bad thing. One of the worst things it does is it vectors particular viruses. So it carries viruses that the bees can catch, and it transmits that viruses between them. So these are viruses that are actually already present in our bee population. But varroa mite makes the amount of virus rise to really high amounts. So our bees in New Zealand are currently, according to current evidence, undergoing an epidemic of a number of viruses. Which are intensely damaging. And we think that many of the effects that we see in America are really fundamentally triggered by the spread of those viruses rather than anything else.
You make it sound like the varroa mites are far more bigger threat than the neonicotinoids.
So I think that at the fundamental level, if you could solve the varroa mite problem, then the neonicotinoid problem would go away to some extent. But the evidence now suggests that bees are affected by these insecticides, even when those insecticides are spread in such a way that they should be at a dose that doesn't kill bees. Now, you and I know that that's probably sensible. I'm sure if you gave me a sublethal dose, a dose of arsenic that wasn't going to kill me, but is still poisonous, I'm not going to be very well. And I think that this is what we've kind of forgotten about many of our ecosystems, that it's not really about killing bees, it's affecting their performance. And bees are so unlike other insects. They have this remarkable social structure, and they have this hierarchy, they have division of labor. And what's happening is that the neonicotinoids are affecting one class, the foragers of that division of labor, and those foragers aren't collecting food, they're getting lost, and that's, of course, making whole colonies starve. So with that on top of a viral infection, you can see that there are a lot of challenges to bees. One of the other issues here is one that's really only just come out, a study which was published last week, which indicates that at least in Europe, about 75% of flying insects are now missing. So this is a long-term survey of flying insects using a particular sort of trap which captures flying insects, not really caring what those insects are, but, you know, sort of saying, okay, well, you know, insects are some measure of the health of an ecosystem. And it turns out that over the last few years, about 75% of those, there's been a decline, about 75% of those flying insects have disappeared. What accounts for this is hard to know, but I find it hard to believe that at least some of that effect isn't a widespread use of insecticides.
We're kind of facing the you know, the DDT moment, aren't we, with the book that came out in the 50s, Silent Spring.
Yes, Silent Spring.
Why do we have neonicotinoids, and why, and what is the use for them, and what do they actually do to insects?
So this is an important point to make, and I know many of your audience into organic and veganism, but neonicotinoids are a class of insecticides that are very useful. And they're very useful because we can put them onto the seed of a plant, let the plant grow, and then that plant will be protected against insects from that seed treatment. So that means we don't need to stick this stuff into an aerial top dresser and spray it over large quantities of the landscape with all the problems of spray drift and various other things. It means that it's that the seeds can be treated in contained facilities so that workers don't get exposed to high levels of these neonicotinoids. So neonicotinoids are a step better than previous things like organophosphates or DDT.
Okay.
So there are reasons to use them. They're a lot safer because of the way that we can use them. They're not safer for insects. I mean, they are designed to kill insects. Bees are insects, they're going to affect bees. But the story that is out there is that for modern production in non-organic environments, that actually insecticides are a benefit to farmers. They see a return on the investment in insecticides, so rather they were using things that were safer for them and safer for the environment in general than some of the older classes of insecticides, which really were horrendous.
Mm.
All of that being said, I think the way that we use insecticides in particular is just appalling. These are compounds that kill every insect, but they'll also kill nematode worms, they'll kill shrimps in streams, they'll kill all kinds of things. It's an extremely broad class of toxins, and I think that you know, too often we regard insects as either all bad, they're all horrible, apart from bees, which we like, and therefore we spray and try and kill all these insects without recognizing that many of them are beneficial, and we could do a better job if we managed the insects that were present in our crops, and bees are, of course, part of that.
So it's a massive biodiversity loss that's happening across the planet, isn't it? That's really a result of the toxicity of the environment, that's what you're saying.
Well, we don't know, I think, in New Zealand whether that's the case.
Mm.
We do know that the study in Europe really frightens me, and that, you know, I'm particularly fond of all sorts of insects, and to hear that we've had reductions of 75%, that is a massive loss of insects.
That is.
In New Zealand, we don't see the effects of chemical sprays on bees. Occasionally you'll hear of beekeepers who have come to their hives and they've all died, and with a bit of poking around, people discover that a farmer has sprayed something nearby. But it's not a widespread problem.
Mm.
I don't know at this point whether we're going to end up with widespread problems, but I think if we don't look at the lessons from overseas, then we're being foolish. I think we have to find some way to balance all of these things so that we can balance both the use of insecticides and the impact that they have on insects. And I think actually what's really needed, and as a researcher I would say this, I think we need to understand better. There is no long-term monitoring in New Zealand of the effect of insecticides on bees.
Mm.
We don't know in New Zealand if there are significant effects happening as they are elsewhere in the world, but we shouldn't jump to conclusions. We need to find out and act accordingly.
So the EPA has got rules around the use of neonics in New Zealand, haven't they? You know, you can't spray them on areas where bees are foraging, and there's various rules. Are they enough?
That's the question that we need to ask. We have a reasonably good oversight, I think, in New Zealand. The EPA does a reasonably good job of trying to ensure that insecticides aren't affecting bees. Mistakes always happen, and of course we hear about those mistakes more often than not. I think we're starting to understand that neonicotinoids also seem to be turning up in things like groundwater and various other things at reasonably high concentrations. So I think we need to stop and look and say, well, okay, where are we having problems, and are those problems really to do with neonicotinoids? Because I think a lot of what we're seeing, as I said before, is due to viruses more than the neonicotinoids themselves. And it's the combination that's the problem.
Mm.
Actually solving the viruses might really make a much bigger difference than banning neonicotinoids. Mm. But without the data, we don't know.
There's also a study that came out just the other day. It was led by a New Zealander, Professor Edward Mitchell of Landcare Research, that found that there was 75% of these bee-killing pesticides present in commercial honey.
Yes, yeah, that's quite remarkable, isn't it?
Mm.
Now, you've got to remember that we have very good biochemical tests for many of these insecticides. So what we're detecting is trace amounts of these things in the honey. I think it's important to note that none of the samples that they tested had amounts of neonicotinoids that are anywhere near the amount that might affect human health, right?
Mm.
But as we know, insecticides are going to have an impact on an insect, and so if it's in their food sources, their overwintering food sources, then that is indeed a particular worry.
Mm.
Again, the data is missing a step, as so much of this work is, because it's hard to get funding for it. Is, you know, actually, yes, we know now that so much of these honeys are contaminated with neonicotinoids. Now we need to know what the impact that is on the bees themselves with some really carefully designed experiments.
We're talking to Professor Peter Dearden, who was the Director of Genetics in Otago and is currently the leader of the Lab in a Box project and Director of Genomics at Aotearoa. Peter, I was just wondering, what is the main function of bees in terms of the importance they are, you know, to us and to ecosystems generally?
Bees are critical to the ecosystems that they came from, which is in Europe mainly and in Africa, but they're also critical to agricultural production. So bees produce honey, of course, and that's a good byproduct, but actually the real value of bees is in pollination. Their activities in pollinating plants underpin all of our horticulture exports. They are vitally important for the pollination, for example, of clover, to ensure that our pastures are enriched each year by nitrogen fixation. These things are critical We call them ecosystem services. Mm. And without them, there's real problems. Many vegetables are pollinated by bees. And in New Zealand, the problem is even worse because so many of our crops come from overseas and we don't have the natural pollinators which might help bees along. Mm. So, you know, if you want to get carrots pollinated, then bees are one of your best options. But that ability to pollinate and cause seeding, etc., is absolutely critical. They say that a third of the food that we eat depends on pollination. Actually, they say a third of the food we eat depends on honeybees. It's not quite true. It does depend on pollination, though. Bees are one of a set of pollinators, and I think we have to be aware that there are lots of other insects out there that have a role in pollination, as well as some vertebrates like bats and birds.
And tell us a bit more about the structure of the bee society. Are there any new developments in terms of our knowledge of bees and how they live as a superorganism, if you like?
Sure. Bees have this remarkable structure. There's a queen bee who does all of the reproducing. There are worker bees who look after the offspring and do the foraging and guarding of the hive. There are male bees which do not very much, frankly, except fertilize the queen. And all of those, that's a remarkable thing. We tend to think that such societies are kind of normal because it reflects our own society, but they're not. There are very few organisms on Earth that have this, what we call, eusocial behavior. Hmm. Understanding how it works is really tricky. The underlying genetics is complex. We don't really understand why these organisms have evolved to produce this eusocial structure. We are starting to understand how the bees do these things. So, for example, my own lab has been looking at how queen bees repress the reproduction of their workers, and we've identified the method by which they do that, and now we're trying to understand how that system might have evolved. But it's a really complex thing, and I think really fascinating thing to look at an organism whose society in some ways mirrors our own, and trying to understand why that's evolved and how it works at the behavioral level, at the molecular level, at the genetic level.
It's really, really amazing creatures, aren't they? I mean, the other big factor, of course, for vegans is this thing about we take their food supply, don't we? I mean, one of the, if you're concerned about bees, why do we take their winter food supply? It's kind of an exploitation of an animal, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So without that exploitation, honeybees would now be extinct everywhere but Australia, which is the only country that still doesn't have varroa mite. So there is an upside to that exploitation because it means we can manage this particular pest. Honeybees really used to be a wild animal that we managed. Mm. Varroa mite has sort of domesticated them. They find it very difficult to live without the treatments that a beekeeper might use, whether organic or chemical. But yes, I think in New Zealand, beekeepers who are good at what they do can critically work out how much honey they can take off without affecting the bee colony too much.
Mm.
But it is, as you say, exploitation of an animal for the production of food.
So what do some beekeepers do to replace that honey? I mean, there's all these kind of myths around it, aren't there? I don't know if they're myths or facts, but we talk about the sort of sugar and putting sugar back in there, or icing sugar or whatever. Does that actually happen, or is that a myth?
So I guess one of the issues, beekeeping is so dependent on the weather. And even the best beekeepers sometimes can't predict that actually there'll be a terribly cold spring, or indeed like last summer, you know, bees were very badly off just because of the quantities of rain and not much warm weather. So sometimes beekeepers will have to feed colonies with sugar, and they do this in such a way as to allow them to get some energy into the hive. Particularly when they're starting up in spring, they're coming out of a cold winter, they're not doing very well, they might give them some sugar to help them off. When it comes to actually production of honey, it's very easy for chemical tests to determine whether a honey product is filled with sugar, effectively with sugar from sugarcane, or whether it's actually honey collected from nectar from flowers. So often it's used as a way to build up a population before a beekeeper will put those bees out into the environment. But yeah, sugar is used as a management tool, but I've seen some of the just fantastic beekeepers that will look at a hive in winter and really be able to judge how much food they need to leave on that hive.
Sure.
So that it comes through the winter fine and is able to really react in spring.
Well, that's a really nice thing to know that beekeepers are doing that. Now, look, we better wind this up pretty soon, but I sometimes find an exhausted bee out on the footpath or somewhere, and I'll even on my windowsill sometimes, and I'll give it a little saucer of water with sugar added to it.
Yep.
And it'll quite often come right within a few minutes and fly away. So what is the best thing that we can do for bees generally in terms of what we can plant? I mean, I have a rosemary bush in my garden grown crazily wild, and I have bees all the time on that plant. I refuse to use any sprays on my property at all, Roundup included. So I'm sure that's helpful to my insects. I've got lots of slugs and insects everywhere. But what does the best thing we can do for bees?
Yeah, so I think thinking about what we plant is a good idea. There are lots of, there's a fantastic program run out of Lincoln University and Landcare called Trees for Bees, which you can look up on the internet, which will give you an indication of what sorts of species of tree are really good for bees, including native ones and trees that will flower at particular times of the year to ensure that there's always food around. So I think if I was planning, you know, a new garden or to plant shelter belts or something on my property, I go to that website and it will tell me exactly what sorts of things would be useful for bees. You know, if just in your garden, you don't really need insecticides. Try and find other ways of solving your insect problems. And you might, you know, you learn some really interesting things. There are companies out there that will sell you little parasitoid wasps, which will attack aphids. There are, you know, people supply ladybirds. Just looking around might provide a solution. And, you know, I'd so much rather not to be spraying my garden with an insecticide when I could fill it with ladybirds to eat all the aphids. It seems to me to be a much more aesthetically pleasing option.
This is another whole discussion we could do a show on, the organic gardening methods that could help bees. So we may get in touch with you again on this.
I'd be delighted to.
Yeah, that'd be lovely. Look, lovely to talk to you, Peter, and thank you so much for being on our show, and it's been really interesting. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
We'll talk again.
Thanks.
Our thanks to Professor Dearden and to Paul. Quite by serendipity today, I was talking with two lovely men who were beekeepers, and they echoed what Peter Dearden said about how if there were no management of bees, they would be extinct because of the varroa mite. And they also assured me that they didn't take all the bees' honey, replacing it with sugar water. And they also tried to minimise other intrusive techniques in hive management in order to help the bees. They told me they liked their bees, they admired them, and tried to manage them in the best and most humane way possible. So one of my students is also a beekeeper, and I know that he has said some similar things to me in the past. Speaking personally, I'm a person who likes all insects, and I've long had an affection for bees. Before I became vegan, I used to eat a lot of honey, and I think that the consumption of honey is maybe an issue where some vegans are a little bit divided. So anyway, I'm doing a bit of a garden rationalisation at the moment, so I'll be getting on to the website Trees for Bees to see what I can find out there. Well, we promised you at the beginning a little bit about birds, and so I'd like to congratulate the kia, New Zealand's cheeky native parrot who's just been named Bird of the Year. The kia resides in the forest and alpine regions of the South Island, but they make themselves pretty obvious where humans frequent also. They've got a lot of natural curiosity and quite a bold nature, and this has often landed them in a spot of trouble. For example, there are a lot of videos around showing them tearing windscreen wipers off cars and so on. But their numbers are in decline, and global warming is set to further limit their range. I read recently, just this week, that some kias have contracted lead poisoning because they lick and chew nails and flashings on older houses and so on. But you've got to love these birds, who once topped the list as the most intelligent animal in the world. I remember reading about that. These feisty personality plus parrots have many challenges to overcome, however. And I'll put some information up on my Facebook page, Safe and Sound Radio Show and Podcast, where you can read more about the kia. And while you're there, please like our page, and maybe you can invite your friends to as well. And so today, instead of a musical track, we'll go out on the call of the kia. So until next time, hei kona mai, kia ora mai. Go well. Bye-bye. Thank you.
You've been listening to Safe and Sound, an animal rights program recorded at Free FM in Hamilton and broadcast through stations in the New Zealand Community Access Radio sector. You can follow the show via their Facebook page, which is Safe and Sound Radio Show and Podcast. And you can download and listen to past episodes by going to accessradio.org or through Apple Podcasts.